Most of you know that I work secular work, and that one of the things that I do is try to get people to invest in things and to spend their money through me to invest in things. And sometimes people want to know if I know the what the economy is going to do in the future. I don't even pretend to be wise when they ask a question like that. I stop and think about that, and I, by the way, I answer them this way. If I knew exactly what was going to happen tomorrow with the economy, do you think I would be out here trying to talk to you about buying something? I would have what little money I could scrape together and my kin folks would lend me in just the right investment. I'd be rich as Croesus, and I wouldn't be talking to people about buying something. Anybody that could actually know, and by the way, that goes for anybody that's trying to sell you something that tells you that he knows what the future holds. He's lying through his teeth. He doesn't know any more about the future than you do. And by the way, that includes economists. Now, they might be able to make better educated guesses, but you know the best educated guess sometimes mess up, don't they? Because educated people listen to other educated people, listen to other educated people, and they can be wrong too. Nobody knows what the future holds. I don't know what tomorrow holds. Do you think that people in our government knew what was going to happen on September the 11th, 2001? People didn't know what was going to happen ahead of time, did they? Nobody had a clue. And after all those investigations, what did they find out? Nobody had a clue. They found out what we all knew ahead of time. People cannot foretell the future. During the days of Isaiah, Judah, of course, was, as had been all the time from the time that Israel became a nation of God, was tempted to go and worship idols. Isaiah was fighting against that. Isaiah, speaking for God, and I said Judah, and this was, at that time when Judah and Israel were separate. Of course, during the days of Isaiah, Israel, the northern tribe, ceased to exist as a kingdom, as a nation. And God, through Isaiah, challenged those who were worshiping the idols. He challenged them to a contest. In Isaiah chapter 44, look at verses 6 through 8. Here's the challenge for the contest. He says, "Thus saith the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first, and I am the last. Besides me, there is no God. And who can proclaim as I do?" Now, he's making a challenge to those who serve other gods. Who can proclaim as I do? Let him declare it and set it in order for me, since I appointed the ancient people and the things that are coming and shall come. Let them show these to them. Now, he's saying, I've shown what, from ancient times, what things are going to come to pass. Now, you bring these prophets of these other gods, and you let them declare what's going to come to pass. He says, "Of them do not fear, nor be afraid. Have I not told you from that time and declared it? You are my witnesses." And by the way, that's not an excuse for us being called Jehovah's Witnesses today. That is saying that you Israelites are my witnesses. You know that I have from ancient times foretold what is going to happen. "Is there a God besides me? Indeed, there is no other rock. I know not one." Now there, the Lord through Isaiah is claiming the unique power that belongs to Him and to Him alone as the all-knowing one, the omniscient one, the one who in His all-knowingness not only knows everything there is now and everything that has occurred in the past, but He also knows the future and can foretell the future. That is a unique characteristic or attribute of Jehovah God that no other being has. God alone has that power. He stated it again in Isaiah chapter 46. And by the way, in chapter 44, verse 28, speaking, of course, Isaiah spoke in the latter part of the 8th century, and he calls in verse 28 Cyrus by name, who would come about 2 centuries later and do his bidding at the conquest of the Babylonian Empire, which was not even the world empire at that time. Assyria was the world empire at that time. And he speaks of a leader in a third world empire that was not a world empire at that time that would come and overtake that second world empire that was not the strong world empire in his time. And so he calls Cyrus by name in Isaiah chapter 44, verse 28, and calls him his servant. That is, he was the one who was doing this for him. And then going down to Isaiah chapter 46, look at verses 8 through 11. Remember this and show yourselves men. Recall to mind, O you transgressors, remember the former things of old. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me. Declaring, now here's his unique ability that only God has. No human has, no angel has. Satan doesn't have this power. Only God has this power. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things that are not yet done. Only God has this power. From the beginning of some great events to tell exactly how they will come out. From the beginning of a nation to tell the end of that nation. From the beginning of time to tell about the end of time. He alone can foresee and can foretell with unerring accuracy what the future holds. And then he goes ahead to speak of Cyrus again in verse 11, calling a bird from the east, the man who executes my counsel from a far country. Indeed, I have spoken, I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, I will also do it. In this particular hour study, we are studying something that Brother William Stewart began yesterday, talking about prophecy. Tomorrow at this time period, then Brother Bobby Graham is going to bring to a close this study of prophecy. And we're using the word prophecy in the restricted sense, foretelling the future. He's going to bring this to a close by talking about Christ in prophecy. It's my assignment to talk about the nation of Israel in prophecy. But there are these great significances, the importances of talking about prophecy. One is it does show that there is one true and living God. I think that all people recognize that no mere human, no person who does not have supernatural power can foretell the future. Now, we might say some things as we go through this lesson about fellows like Nostradamus that people today think had some kind of a power. Have you ever read the writings or some of the writings of Nostradamus? I've read just a little bit of it. It's just such gobbledygook that you can make anything of it. And I think that is the reason people can take that and make whatever they want to of it. It doesn't make any sense. And so anything you want to make of it, you can make of it. And so if you want to try to insert something from history today into it and say, doesn't that fit? Well, I can't say that it doesn't because I can't make any sense of what he said. Now, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about clear, compelling foretelling of events long before they came about. And you know, this is something that I would challenge any false religions on. Mormons have tried to mimic the historical evidences of the Scriptures, and their attempts to mimic that are laughable. They're unlike what Oscar has shown us today concerning the historical accuracy of the Bible. When you try to confirm, for example, the Book of Mormon and its tales about people coming over here in a boat that they had turned over and over, and they had to keep a cork in the part that was down, and starting the ancient Indian people living here and so forth, it just becomes laughable. And to try to do anything from archaeology to sustain that is absolute nonsense. And our Mormon friends try to find places where Joseph Smith foretold the future. One of their favorite stories about Joseph Smith foretelling the future is that in 1835, I think it was, that Joseph Smith foretold that there would be a great civil war in our country. Well, now that was really smart. You know, I can go back to the late 1700s and show that leaders in our country were saying then, either we've got to solve this problem of slavery or this nation going to divide and we're going to have a great civil war. People knew that in the late 1700s. I mean, so Joseph Smith, you know, 25 years before it happened, had sense enough, as people have been saying for a long time, that we're going to have a great civil war. You've got to do better than that to have any confidence that this man had any kind of inspiration from the Lord. But I believe that we can go to the Scriptures and we can show prophecies of events that happened not just a few years, but many centuries before those events occurred. And we can show that they occurred even as the Bible foretold that they would occur. Yesterday, again, William Stewart showed that concerning the nations that existed around the nation of Israel. Now, the problem that I have this morning in talking about the nation of Israel is that most of the Old Testament prophecies deal with one of two subjects: either the nation of Israel or Christ. And now Bobby Grant's going to have that problem tomorrow morning, that is selecting from all of the richness of material. Now, that you will have to select from, that's the problem that I have this morning. I have chosen to select from three specific sources. For one reason, two of them are very comprehensive. One of these, by the way, two of these sources were from around the same time. In fact, almost exactly the same time. One of them non-Israelite and one of them Israelite. One of my favorite stories, and I'm sure that of other preachers and Bible class teachers in this audience, one of our favorite stories from the Old Testament is the story of Balaam. And I could spend the rest of my time, and I'm sure other preachers could also hear, just talking about Balaam and great lessons to be learned from Balaam. He was a prophet of God, but he was not an Israelite. In fact, he lived up close to the Euphrates River. And during this time, and we're now, if you want to turn your Bibles to Numbers chapters 22 through 24, I'm just going to briefly reiterate the story there and then deal with some specific things that Balaam foretold, as Moses records in Numbers chapter 22. Now, this is at the end of the time, or toward the end of the time, of Israel wandering in the wilderness. And they now have come over to the plains of Moab. And I guess I should have had this up on the map over here to make this more easily followed. But now the older generation has died off, and the new generation has come on that will take the land. In fact, they're given in Numbers chapter 26, the numbers of the new generation. And they're now in the plains of Moab, over on the east side of the Dead Sea. And Balak, king of Moab, is just deathly afraid of this, to him, this great mob of a nation that is coming through his land, and he's afraid, although they're not interested in taking Moab, that they're going to defeat him, and he needs some kind of supernatural help to make sure that they don't overtake him. So he sends his messengers way up to almost where the Euphrates River is to summon a prophet who has the reputation for having a lot of power. And whatever he says, that's the way it's going to be. Now, this man happens to be a prophet of Jehovah, a prophet of the Lord. Now, this man, and it shows you that God can use people, even though their faith is not what it should be, and even their knowledge is not what it should be. Balaam was not an Israelite. He was a Gentile, but he was a prophet of the Lord. And Balaam even went in to use some things that would be very, very close to magician-type things, which, of course, were forbidden by the law of Moses. But the Lord used him to tell things that would come to pass in what was to them the latter days, many years after the time when they lived. But Balak sent up to him and brought him down to try to curse Israel, because he believed if Balaam would curse Israel, then Israel would be cursed, and there's nothing they could do. And you remember how that Balaam went and asked the Lord. The Lord said, don't go with them. And so they returned, and Balak thought he was just playing hardball with him and that he just wanted more money. And so he sent back and said, "Why, you know, whatever it takes, I'll pay you. Come on." And Balaam made a great mistake. He'd already heard what the Lord said, but he went back and asked him again. Now, there's a great mistake. When people know, you go to the Bible, you know what the Lord says, but you don't like that, and so you see if you can find more. Well, you always find what you're looking for. It's not really there, but you can twist something to make it seem as it's there. So Balaam went back, and of course this time the Lord allowed him to go, but of course he shouldn't have, because the Lord already told him not to go. And you remember how that on the way he had an argument with his donkey. I love that story. As he's riding along on his donkey, and of course the angel of the Lord stands in the way with the drawn sword. The donkey saw the angel of the Lord, but Balaam didn't. And of course the donkey turned out into the field, and Balaam beat the donkey with his staff, and the donkey turned back onto the road, and he came to a narrow place, and there the angel of the Lord was again, and the donkey turned against a wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall, and he beat him again, and finally came to a place where there's nothing the donkey could do except just to lay down. And there the angel of the Lord was, and the donkey lay down under Balaam, and Balaam beat on the donkey again, and the Lord opened the donkey's mouth and said, "Why are you beating me?" I just love that story. And can you imagine a man getting in an argument with a donkey? That man was mad. He was beside himself with anger to get in an argument with a donkey. He should have realized something's going on here. But he said, "If I had a sword, I'd kill you." And the donkey, "Have I ever been to treat you this way? Haven't I always been your faithful donkey?" And for some reason that caused Balaam to think. And he said, "Well, no, you've never done this way." And then his eyes were opened, and he saw the angel of the Lord. He lost an argument with a donkey. Would you like to lose an argument with a donkey? Now, that's pretty bad, isn't it? And his eyes were opened, and he saw the Lord, or the angel of the Lord, and realized. And so he, of course, offered to go back. But the angel said, "You know, you go ahead, but you only..." Now, here's the key. "You only speak the words which I put in your mouth." Now that's inspiration, isn't it? Only speak the words that I put in your mouth. And Balaam is a great illustration of what inspiration is and what revelation and prophecy is. The man only spoke the words which God put in his mouth. So he came to Balak, and he had Balak offer the offerings and so forth, and he went off by himself to receive the revelation from God, and apparently would fall into a trance and receive this revelation. But Balak had him stand on the brow of the hill overlooking Israel that was in the valley below, and in the wasteland below, close to the Dead Sea, the plains of Moab. And he opened his mouth and spoke. And rather than cursing Israel, a blessing came out. Now look at Numbers chapter 23, verse 9. We'll just look at some very specific things that he has to say concerning Israel. But every time, rather than cursing Israel, as Balak had hired him to do, he blessed Israel, because he could only speak the words which God put in his mouth, and Balak never could get that through his head, that Balaam could only speak those words which God put in his mouth. And he said, "From the top of the rocks I see him." In other words, I'm looking down on him. "And from the hills I behold him. There a people dwelling alone, not reckoning itself among the nations. Now, that is some very great insight concerning the nature of Israel as a nation that Balaam is there expressing, by the way, which has been the nature of the Jewish people as a people ever since the law was given them at Mount Sinai. That law that was given them at Mount Sinai caused them to be a completely unique nation, different from all other peoples that have lived upon the face of the earth. They alone were the chosen people as a physical nation, the chosen people of the Lord God who created the heaven and the earth. No other nation, no other physical lineage of people that's ever lived could make that claim. And they were very well aware of that. And unfortunately, although there's abundant teaching to them not to let that cause them to have pride, that it caused an abundance of pride among them. They alone were God's chosen people as a physical nation. The other nations had their own peculiar gods, but they recognized that these are just tribal gods or national gods or a group or a pantheon of national gods. But Israel alone, and by the way, they had nothing against other people worshiping their own national gods. That's what they expected them to do. And however strong their national gods were, they figured that's how strong they were as a nation. But Israel alone, of all the people of the earth, realized there is one true and living God who made the heaven and the earth, and He has chosen Israel to be His people. And we're to serve Him, and there are no other gods. We can't recognize these gods of the nations. They are no gods. We're a totally different people, separate. And gave them a law, which meant, for example, they could only eat certain things and could not eat the dainties that other people... What do you think the problem was that Daniel and Mishael and Azariah and so forth had when they came into Babylon in Daniel chapter 1? There were foods, the king's dainties that were given that they could not partake of. They were a nation, a group of people, ever since to this very day, to this very hour, a nation separate, unique, different from all the peoples of the earth that have ever existed. And all the problems that have been brought upon the Jews to this day can be coupled with that fact that God made them a unique people when He gave them His law and gave them His covenant on Mount Sinai. And thus, Balaam expressed a great insight, of course, by inspiration of God, concerning that which becomes the unique characteristic of this nation from that time on and as a people to this very day. Well, we read on, and in verse 10, and by the way, I'm skipping over obviously a lot of things. He says, "Who can count the dust of Jacob? Our number 1/4 of Israel, let me die the death of the righteous, let my end be like his." Now, it is true that the time that Balaam spoke, that Israel was a great nation, mighty and populous. But what's going to happen to this people? This is a band of people that would appear to the nations that they were marching among were disorganized, although they were not disorganized. God had organized them at Mount Sinai. And they're going up to take Canaan, and they're going to fight against nations that are greater and mightier than they. And they're either going to take over those nations, or they're going to be destroyed as a people. And Balaam foretells that they're going to be great and mighty and continue to be that way. Now, by the way, we do know something concerning their population later on, because you remember David made a census that God didn't authorize him to make. It was a sinful thing that he did. At the time that David made that census, Israel's army numbered over 1.5 million. Though at the time that Balaam made this prophecy, their army numbered about 600,000. So in that time period, between the time when Balaam spoke, around 1450 B.C. or somewhere around there, to the time when David did that census, somewhere around 1000 A.D., so a period of over 450 years, they had greatly increased in number. And thus, this could have gone either way. They could have been totally destroyed. And if you looked at it from a human standpoint, you thought, well, they're going up against nations greater than they're going to be destroyed. But Balaam foretold they would become a great multitude of people. And in fact, that they would become very powerful. Going down to chapter 23, the second of Balaam's prophecies. And he says, look, a people rises like a lioness and lifts itself up like a lion. It shall not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. So they're going to be a victorious nation. Now, from a human standpoint, you would have said the opposite when Balaam spoke these things. And then going down to chapter 24, look at verses 7 and 17. And there, he predicts that they're going to have a king. Now, that would not be greatly surprising to predict that this people would have a king. You figure if they settle in the land, become a nation, then they would eventually have a king, which they did have. But in verse 7, he says, of what God will do for them, he shall pour water from his buckets, his seed shall be in many waters. And then he says, concerning the result, his king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. So they're going to have a king. He's going to be a great king, an exalted king. He says more in his final prophecy in verse 17 concerning Israel. Verse 17, I see him, but not now. So this is not going to happen right away. I behold him, but not near. This is not going to happen immediately. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter, scepter, of course, as the symbol of rule, rise out of Israel and batter the brow of Moab, and destroy all the sons of tumult. He goes ahead to predict that he's going to conquer Edom, that he's going to conquer the Amalekites, and of course you recognize that that's exactly what David did. And so many, many years later, after all the period of the judges had transpired, so over 400 years had transpired to Balaam, many years yet in the future, to Moses, many years yet in the future, there was indeed one arose, and his name was David. He was a great king, and David ruled over all of the land that God had promised to Abraham way back in Genesis chapter 12. By the way, to tie this in with Abraham further, go back to verse 9 of Numbers chapter 24, and look at the second part of that verse. Blessed is he who blesses you, and cursed is he who curses you. Does that sound familiar? Where would we first read that? Yeah, that's right. That's a part of the Abrahamic promise, isn't it? And what Balaam is doing is pronouncing the Abrahamic promise upon Israel as a nation. And that God gave to Abraham many centuries before this is now going to be fulfilled upon Israel, his descendants. That's right. And so that's in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, that great blessing that God gave to Abraham that Balaam here repeats. And thus, many years, many centuries before much of this came to pass, Balaam, a prophet of God, as recorded by Moses in the book of Numbers, wrote down for us exactly what Israel's future would be like, and it all came to pass just as Balaam said it would. Now, at the same time, of course, Moses obviously lived at that time, since Moses lived there or thereafter, but he lived at that time, because Moses recorded what Balaam wrote, but Moses himself made similar prophecies concerning Israel, both before and after the time that Balaam spoke. In Leviticus chapter 26, which we don't have in the notes that you have, but you can write that in next to Deuteronomy 28 if you want to. In Leviticus chapter 26, Moses delivered the blessings and the curses for Israel, for the first generation, the generation that came out of Egypt, that were adults when they left Egypt. And now by the time that we read the book of Deuteronomy, that generation is dead. A new generation has come along, and Moses delivers to them the blessings and the cursings. And so this is really similar, or parallel, not just similar, it's perfectly parallel to Leviticus chapters 26, but it's repeated and given in more detail for the younger generation, the generation that will go into Canaan. Now, these blessings and cursings that Moses delivered to them, as recorded in Deuteronomy chapter 28, were dependent upon whether they obeyed God or not. verses 1 through 14 of Deuteronomy chapter 28 are the blessings that Israel would receive if they remained faithful to the Lord. And there was a time in their nation, in their history, when these blessings came upon them under David, the first part of the reign of Solomon, because they were faithful to the Lord and they received those blessings. And all of those wonderful things that God said about them through Moses in Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14, came to pass. But in most of their history, they were unfaithful to the Lord. And thus the curses, beginning in verse 15 and going to the end of the chapter, verse 68, become Israel's history written in advance simply because they did not obey the voice of the Lord as given first through Moses and then through the prophets. They were to have a king. Of course, they had a king. And I'm going to hit some things very quickly. They were to become a byword. Look at verse 37 of Deuteronomy chapter 28. You shall become an astonishment, a proverb, and a byword among all nations where the Lord will drive you. You know what that means in essence? That wherever they go, when they're being driven out of their land and taken into captivity, are forced to wander from nation to nation, that people will be prejudiced against them and would say bad things about them, and they would become the butt of jokes. They would become the source of sayings of people, well, you're as bad as that bunch of Jews, or you're just like a Jew. Now, has that come to pass? Has that been fulfilled? That's still true to this day. I'm sure that you have, or some of you have watched the musical Fiddler on the Roof. And of course, that's about Jews in Russia just before and during the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. And it's a very sad movie or play or musical that you watch. And the people, it shows the prejudice that even to modern times against the Jews as a people, because primarily of their separateness as a people, which is the exact result of the law given to them at Mount Sinai, and of course the traditions that they've added to that. Their separateness causes them still to this day to be a byword, a curse, a proverb, a hiss, a sneer, people always saying evil things about Jews to this very day. And so there's something that Moses foretold would happen and continues to this very present day to happen if they would not obey the voice of the Lord. A nation would come from far and come against. Look at verses 49 and 50. The Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flies, a nation whose language you will not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, which does not respect the elder nor show favor to the young. Now, try to step back into the time when Moses lived. And there was a great nation that Israel had left, and that, of course, was Egypt. But the great empires that later arose that would control that part of the world had not arisen at this time. And around them were smaller peoples, tribes, and small nations, not the great nation. It would be like if you could try to place yourself, for those of you who studied a little bit of history of Europe, in the earlier Middle Ages, when the nation states that now are in Europe and are world powers had not arisen. And all you have is Germanic tribes. You've got the Franks over here and the Visigoths over here and stuff like that. And that's kind of the situation that Israel was in. And try to imagine if you lived in that time frame and you had never seen a time when great nations would arise and go a long way off and conquer nations a long way from them. That was something you were totally unfamiliar with. And somebody to tell you, now, if you don't keep God's word, a great nation from afar is going to come and take over. You know, that sounds strange to you. But, you know, when we look back on that, it's not strange at all, is it? Because we know that, now going over the time of the judges, because that was primarily just surrounding nations that oppressed them, although the Sumerians did come with them, and Mesopotamians came up against them, that was from afar. But come on down to the latter part of the nation of Israel, and you remember, of course, the Assyrians grew as the great world power. And they were the ones who did, as Oscar brought it earlier this morning, encircle Hezekiah and keep him in like a bird in a cage. But they didn't take Judah, but they did take Israel. And they did destroy the northern nation and took them into captivity. And then later on with the Babylonians, of course, as a congregation, we're now studying the book of Jeremiah. So we've learned a lot about Babylon and what they did during that time, and how Nebuchadnezzar did come up and take them, a nation that came from afar and they didn't understand their language. And then Persia after that, although, as Oscar brought up earlier today, the Persians allowed them to return to their homeland, as Jeremiah said would happen, and as Isaiah said would happen. And then, of course, the Macedonians and the Greco-Macedonian kingdom coming, and finally the Romans. In other words, it's repeated over and over again, because something which would be very hard for somebody in Moses even to picture in his mind, and yet it happened repeatedly because of this obedience to God. And the terrible siege that's pictured, and I'm not going to read all of verses 52 through 57, read it on your own. Moses prophesied that in the terrible siege of their city, the city of Jerusalem, it was not even their city at that time, belonged to the Jebusites, that in that terrible siege, that the tender, delicate woman who wouldn't even like to put the sole of her foot to the ground, she didn't go around barefoot, she couldn't take that. The tender, delicate woman, that she would eat her own child. Do you know that that happened, recorded repeatedly, at least three different times in the history of the Jewish nation, because of the horribleness of the siege? The first time it's recorded is in 2 Kings chapter 6, and this is one perhaps we don't know about, most people know about as well, because the Syrians came up. Now, this is not the Assyrians, this is the Syrians, and besieged Jehoram, the son of Ahab. And one of the women called out to him as he was on the wall, help. And what she wanted to help was that this woman, other woman, and she had agreed that she would kill her son today and boil him, we'd eat him, and the next day we'd kill the other woman's son and eat him. And we did that to my son, she said, and now the other woman's hid her son. Well, that was great news to Jehoram, wasn't it? Can you imagine the horribleness of that? And so Jehoram tore his clothes as the result, and the people saw that he was wearing sackcloth under his clothing. But you know, later on, when Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem, and Jeremiah wrote the Lamentations, the weepings, the mournings over that conquest, both in Lamentations chapter 2, verse 20, and in chapter 4, verse 10, it talks about the women eating their own children during that siege. In the book of Josephus, I brought this with me. Now, many of you are already familiar, but this is something that's interesting to me, because if you want to read some secular confirmation of biblical history, then this book that's very easily available, the works of Josephus and in his Wars of the Jews. And I've made some references to that in the outline, but some of you, I'm sure, already have a copy of Josephus' works. Then you can read for yourself Josephus' very horrible account of a woman by the name of Mary in the Roman siege of Jerusalem in AD 70, who killed, roasted, and ate her own infant son. And so repeatedly, this very thing that Moses said would happen because of the disobedience to God, something as horrible as I think we can imagine, something that did happen over and over again in their terrible sieges, and that their end would be captivity and wandering throughout the world. And do you know, the Jews stand. Now I want to stop right here and let you understand, I don't believe that I am anti-Semitic. I have nothing against any Jew as a person, and nothing against the Jews as a people. This is simply a matter of historical fact. This is what has happened. is that because of, as a nation, their rejection of the law of God and eventually their rejection of Christ the Messiah, that these things continue to come upon them as a people to this very day. What do you think the Holocaust is all about? There's nothing been more horrible happen in modern times than the Holocaust. And that is the direct result of what Moses said would happen because of, as a people, their rejection of God's law and their rejection of the Christ would come upon them. I didn't say that to justify any Nazi. There could not be a more horrible group of people than the Nazis. I didn't say that to justify any anti-Semitism. I believe that hatred and prejudice against any people as a group or as an individual is wrong, and God forbids it. But it's a historical fact that has come upon them as a nation and as a people because of their rejection of God. Well, real quickly, then I'm going to finish because this has been a long morning. Jeremiah prophesied that after they were taken into captivity, that a remnant would return. Now, Moses prophesied it, Isaiah prophesied it, Jeremiah prophesied it, Ezra showed that it came to pass under Cyrus, as Oscar's already talked about this morning. Now, let me make this note. From those people who consider themselves to be Bible believers, people who would think that they believe every word of the Bible, and oftentimes they say that they take the Bible literally, and but these people usually are premillennial, and actually what they do is destroy some of the great evidences of the Bible of prophecy by refusing to recognize those prophecies have been fulfilled and therefore are great evidence for us of inspiration of the Scriptures. And they're still looking for these prophecies yet to be fulfilled, and in doing so, taking away, this is just one thing that's wrong with premillennialism, taking away from us some of the great evidence we have of inspiration of the Scriptures. The prophecies of the restoration have been fulfilled. In fact, go to another chapter in Ezra, because what is usually said by our premillennial friends is that Judah returned, but the 10 northern tribes never returned. They'll talk about the lost tribes of Israel. And they never returned, and so sometime in the future they've got to return. So they're saying that these things have not been fulfilled. They're taking away our evidence, which is good evidence for the inspiration of the Scriptures. But in Ezra chapter 2, the inspired writer Ezra goes through a list of the peoples and where they settled that came back because of the decree of Cyrus in about 535-536 BC that the Jews could return. And look at the last verse of the chapter. Ezra chapter 2 verse 70. So the priests and the Levites, some of the people, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the Nethinim dwelt in their cities and all Israel in their cities. There were people from all the tribes of Israel. A remnant, just as Isaiah had said many years prior. A remnant who returned, and the restoration promises were fulfilled. They stand as great evidence for the inspiration of the Scriptures that God did indeed foretell the future. But the Jews as a nation. Now, where can I go today to find the ancient nation of Egypt? Don't say Egypt. That's not the ancient nation of Egypt. In fact, I don't know if you think about that. That ancient people of Egypt were descendants of Ham. Many, many centuries ago, they were overrun by descendants of Shem, who now, the Arabs, who now inhabit and rule that land. The ancient Egyptians as a nation ceased to exist a long time ago. The modern nation of Egypt is not a symbol. It's not even the same people as that ancient nation of old. Where would I go to find the modern nation of Babylon? Well, geographically, we would go to Iraq, wouldn't we? But that would be a different people, a different nation. Where would I go to find modern Persia? Well, geographically, it would be Iran, wouldn't it? But again, different people, different nations. Here's the point. Where could I go to find all those nations that existed at the time of ancient Israel? They're all gone. They're, as we say, they're history. They're long gone. But the Jews, as a people, continue to this day to exist as a separate people. By the way, just an interesting point, the largest group of Jews in the world is not in the nation of Israel. They're down there with Brother Sister Hall. The largest group of Jews in the world. That's right. And still to this day, existing as a people separate from others because of their traditions, because of their beliefs, because of their culture, existing as a people separate from all others. What if I were to say, sometime in the future, France will cease to exist, Germany will cease to exist, such and such will cease to exist, the United States will cease to exist. Of course, people would hit me over the head with the flag. But such and such a people, a minor little people that nobody knows much about, as long as it continues, they'll continue. Well, you're crazy, Keith. Well, I would be crazy because I can't foretell things like that. But that's what the Bible did in Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 11. They would never cease to exist as a people, although all those nations cease to exist. And so, to this very day, the Jewish people, as a separate people, stand as a monument to the accuracy of the Word of God and to the fact. Well, let's say it together. You can say it with me, and this will bring our lesson to a close. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 and 17. Everybody just feel free to say it with me. All Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, perfect, if you will, thoroughly furnished to all good works. Thank you for coming.